out.
I'm walking here.
You talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I hear you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
We are Movie Geeks. Good morning, this is Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. Today is August 3rd. Let's get right down to business like we usually do. We don't want to waste any time. We're going to talk about the top 10 box office. Michelle McHugh is here. She was gone last week, but she is back. Michelle, what happened at the box office?
Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, number one at the box office with an estimated $56 million. The fifth installment also took in $121 million worldwide in 41 countries. This is the third best opening for Tom Cruise behind the original Mission Impossible and War of the Worlds. It was slated to open at Christmas, but Paramount decided to move it up so to clear it out for Star Wars opens. Yeah. And Paramount has also announced that they are going to be shooting next summer the sixth movie.
I heard Tom saying that with Jon Stewart last week.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know what? Despite Alex Gibney's documentary, you know, going clear on the Scientology, it didn't seem to hurt. People still like Tom Cruise.
Well, why would it if you think about it?
Yeah. So Mission Impossible was number one. It still has 25 markets to open in the coming weeks, including China in September. Number two was Vacation. Came in at a paltry 14.8.
I'll interrupt you here, but what did they announced a director for part six?
No, they haven't. Okay. They're
Christopher. Part five, I guess.
It'd be number six. Yeah. Christopher McQuarrie directed this last one, so he might be back, you know, to helm the next one.
Okay, go on. You say Vacation was number two with $14
million. $14.8 million, far from the projected $30 million that opening weekend that Warner Brothers had expected. So coming in kind of soft. Number three was Ant-Man with $12.6 million. The Disney film is doing really well, along with Inside Out in the United Kingdom. Number four, Universal's Minions. $12.2 million. It's passed Shrek 3 to become the ninth highest grossing animated film. Number five was Sony's Pixels with 10.4. It brings it to a cumulative total of $45.6 million.
Has anyone seen Pixels in this room?
No.
You know, a couple weeks ago we had the screening and we were like, we all can't go, Dane. And Dane fell for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Dane went and saw it, but he kind of liked it. So good.
Yeah.
The one person who liked it got to see it.
Then you got him to whitewash your fence.
Three out of five. It's really fun.
Number six was Trainwreck from Universal, $9.7 million. Coming in at seven and eight was Southpaw, Anton Fuqua's drama. That and number eight, Paper Towns, both have had big drop-offs
this weekend.
Yeah, Southpaw,
you know, when the trailer came out, I guess early in the year, that really looked like a sort of an Oscar contender. Mm-hmm. It looked like it was going to be kind of a big deal. It looked like it was going to be a movie a lot of people were talking about until people actually saw it. And it looks like it's going to be kind of pretty much forgotten by Oscar season.
Yeah, it was an interesting release date. Number nine was Inside Out from Disney. Number 10, rounding out, was Jurassic World from Universal with $3.8 million.
So still in the top 10.
Yeah, but Mr. Holmes has fallen off the top 10. Mm-hmm. I actually saw Mr. Holmes over the weekend.
Came in at number 11.
Did it come in at number 11? Mm-hmm. All right. I thought it was a really good movie.
Yeah, you saw that, Michelle, also, didn't you?
Yeah. Yes, I did. Yeah.
Jim,
I did.
You gave it a very positive review. Did you give it five stars?
I gave it five stars. Okay, I was just bowled over by Ian McKellen in it.
Yeah.
I thought he did a terrific job.
I was kind of surprised by the movie. It wasn't what I was expecting at all. I was expecting, you know, Sherlock Holmes. I was expecting this mystery, but it's not really. It's really like two or three mysteries.
Yeah.
And they're sort of small-scale mysteries that are very personal to this old Sherlock Holmes, and I was really surprised just how sad and melancholy and emotional the movie was.
Mm-hmm. He's pretty much, you know, what they call it, the last man standing.
Mm-hmm.
And he recognizes that or sort of has a tribute to all of his fallen comrades at the end of it. Mm-hmm. It's very very moving.
It is. And it sort of reminded me of Gods and Monsters, which was the other movie that Bill Condon and Ian McKellen teamed up on, 15 years ago now. You know, you even had sort of Laura Linney was sort of playing a similar character that Lynn Redgrave played in that. So I really like this film. It caught me by surprise.
Yeah, the relationship with him and the her son is very good in it, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I mentioned about the when the son mouths off to mom and Sherlock says, "Do you apologize right now? What
That's
are
a
you
great
doing?"
Scene. And, hoping Ian McKellen sees the nomination.
Oh,
I really
so,
do.
Too.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, I hope it's not forgotten by
oh,
then.
I would
it hasn't, you know, it's not. It doesn't have a whole lot of buzz. It's not a movie I hear people talking about, which is unfortunate.
But once the DVD screeners start rolling out in the fall, I'm just really hoping.
It's from Weinstein, isn't it? So he's going to be sending out a lot of discs,
This is from Roadside Attractions, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, they send out a lot of
they do
too.
Too.
Yeah.
They do too.
Now, I don't know if we addressed the film within a film that's in the movie, which is very, very rewarding when you find out about it afterwards.
And it was... And that movie was called Lady in Grey.
But there
was Woman in Green. I think it was supposed to be a spoof of that. And it says starring George Armitage instead of Basil Rathbone. But wasn't there a silent film star named Armitage?
It sounds like it. But what I found interesting, I don't know if we talked about that, is the actor that plays the actor playing Sherlock Holmes in that scene.
Who was that?
That's Nicholas Rowe from Young Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, is that right?
That was a nice touch.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I was looking at him and said, is something vaguely familiar about him? And then I looked it up on IMDb and I was like, well, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
He's been keeping very active in supporting roles
over
the years. Yeah,
he looked familiar, but clever bit of casting.
Yeah. And I was like, that's a nice little
So he played Sherlock Holmes 30 years ago? I guess Sherlock Holmes was a teenager in that time, so that makes sense.
Yeah, it came out, in 84, 85?
Something like that.
Still a great little film.
Yeah, it was one of the first uses of CGI, if I remember correctly.
That's right. Yeah, so that was a nice touch. My only problem with that sequence is I think that the music could have been adjusted so it could have sounded more like a lush, you know, full orchestral thing that they would have had in the 30s or 40s.
They would have used.
But the reaction shots of Holmes, the real Holmes in the theater watching the fake Holmes is very, very funny.
Yeah, but that's fallen off the top 10. Mission Impossible was number one, like Michelle said, which won $56 million, earned $56 million, I should say.
Benji.
Ethan, where are you?
The Syndicate is real. A rogue nation trained to do what we do.
An anti-IMF.
I reviewed it at WeAreMovieGeeks.com, our website. I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. I thought it was really a fantastic adventure film. It didn't, you know, have a whole lot of story. I think these Bond movies are becoming more and more like the 007 movies because of an American 007, especially that opening with the Tom Cruise crawling out on the side of the airplane. That reminded me of something you'd see at the opening of the Bond, especially one of the Roger Moore James Bond films that always opened with a sequence like that.
If I can interject, that plane stunt was in the script, was originally supposed to be at the end.
Oh, yeah.
That was supposed to be him, Ethan Hunt, going on his next journey to segue. Mm-hmm. Ethan Hunt will be back in Mission Impossible 6. Oh. So that was originally supposed to be at the end.
Huh.
I don't know if I read it or heard it on an interview last week that they actually put together the stunt sequences first and then sort of write the script around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what it seemed like, to tell you the truth. And in the scene with the opera house, you know, That would have been the climax of a lesser film, but that was like 30 minutes in, and that was just spectacular the way it was choreographed.
You know what it calls to mind, Mr. Cruise in these films, is that it kind of harkens back to even the silent era to Doug Fairbanks Sr. and dare I say Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd.
I've said that in my review. It was some Buster Keaton style choreography with the ladders and the curtains and some of the stunts that he was doing in that opera house. While the opera is going on the stage beneath him, he's up there battling villains with nobody in the audience apparently paying any attention.
The action scenes were so well done. The motorcycle chase scene, unbelievable.
That's very nice. Yeah. Now it reminded me a little too much though of the climax of the second film, which was kind of turned me off to the third film. Then I came back with the last film with Ghost Protocol.
Is the second film your favorite?
No. The
second film was nobody's favorite.
The second film
was directed by John Woo, who was a pretty hot property at the time. He had made these amazing action films in China, Bullet in the Head and The Killer, and Hard Boiled, and then he came to the U.S. and did a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie and then did Mission Impossible 2, and then I think he sort of slunk back to China. I don't think he's been working in Hollywood since.
Yeah, I'm wondering though, could we talk a little bit in depth about the ending there? I don't know if I'm going to get too close to doing a spoiler or not, but there's something about it I thought about it. It felt very satisfying to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we can say. Well, you know, the IMF force is going to triumph. You kind of know that, right?
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. But instead of with a lot of Bond films, you see the villain plunging to his death or being blown
perishing.
Up. In this one, he's captured alive, but it's more of a punishment to him, I think. This is kind of a stretch. It even harkens back to like Bugs Bunny films. It's not the pain he's inflicting on Yosemite Sam or Elmer Fudd. It's the knowledge that he's outsmarted them, and it just kills the villain.
That's even worse than being killed. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So, and this harkens back to the old TV series. Most of the episodes of the TV series would end with the IMF gang getting into the van and driving off and sort of looking back in their rearview mirror at the evil dictator or the gangster being hauled away or being swept up somehow. Here they present themselves to the villain. It's like, this is the IMS. We've taken you down. Yeah. We want you to remember us while you're sitting in a hole somewhere, wherever they're going to put you away. In the darkest corner in the darkest prison.
What did you think of Sean Harris as the villain?
He's a real dissible villain. He's dislikable. But that's another thing. He thinks he's intellectually superior to all of them. Mm-hmm. And that's, you just know that this is going to be, he's going to be going through everything in his head the whole, however many more years he's going to have left.
That's right. I thought he was a bit of a weak link. I thought Sean, in fact, I said in my review, his most distinguishing feature is his weak chin. He was just.
And we saw him in Prometheus.
He didn't have a lot of hissable charisma as a villain. Mm-hmm. I didn't think.
Although casting Rebecca Ferguson, I thought was genius. I think she's smart. I think she's sexy. I think she can hold. And she proves. And Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie, they wanted to find an actress who could hold her own on the screen. Both smart, sexy, the whole. Yeah, I loved her. And I first noticed her actually in the Starz miniseries White Queen, and also she was also in Hercules.
Yeah, that's right. Which I watched that night. It was on Netflix when I got Mission Impossible.
So I really liked her.
I liked her so much, I sought her out.
She's rocking that yellow dress, I tell you, the opera sequence. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. But although I must say Paula Patton, I thought, was very strong in the last Mission Impossible film. She has a fantastic fight scene. I think it's with Léa Seydoux, who's going to be in the next Bond film.
That is a great fight scene.
But it's got some really strong sequences there. I think the plot gets a little too convoluted there for its own good for a lot of it. I love the rapport with Ethan Hawke. And Simon Pegg's character, very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hunt. Oh, you caught me in a senior moment again. I tell you.
Ethan Hawke was in St. Louis over the weekend, and he was in the Tivoli.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I don't know what he's doing in town. Does anybody know? Is he filming something? Has he seen a band or something? The management of the. I was at the Tivoli over the weekend. We did The Room with Tommy Wiseau, and everyone was excited because Ethan Hawke had stopped by the Tivoli.
Yeah, he just heard what a rockin' town St. Louis is.
Yeah, or maybe he wanted to meet Tommy Wiseau, his acting hero. All right, what else did we see last week? Jim pretty much reviewed Vacation. I caught up with Vacation. I went and saw it Wednesday or Thursday night. Actually, I saw it Tuesday night, the night before it opened. I thought it was really funny. I laughed out loud over and over and over. In fact, I thought it was a really funnier film than Trainwreck or one of the other comedies that have come out lately. With the opening titles are funny with these found family photos, which they would wipe away, and there would be something going on in the photo you didn't see at first. And they did that during the closing credits as well with stuff that they made up, which was really, really funny. Ed Helms was surprisingly funny. I've never really liked him all that much. He's always seemed like a TV guy to me, but I thought he did a great job.
I'd like to see him in something that's, I don't know, really well written. I think we're missing. There's a role waiting for him out there.
Did you see Cedar Rapids?
Yeah,
very good in that.
I did.
I thought that was pretty well written.
Were
you surprised, Tom, at the slapstick skills of Miss Applegate in it?
Oh, well, not really, because I've seen her being funny in many films in the past. She's always been a natural comedian.
I never this physical before. I was really surprised, But she does a lot of verbal sparring with Ron Burgundy, but here she's getting really down and dirty with it,
Then the sons, the whole running gag with the younger brother totally being a bully to his older brother was really, really funny. And then some of the dialogue with the older brother and the dad, you know, what's a rim job, dad? I'm going to give you a rim job, son. And
which was in the credits and the trailer.
The red band.
Ooh.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of critics that have mentioned probably too many gags were given away in the trailers, but that's the deal these days. They want to tell you just about everything in the trailer, so which is, you know, unfortunate.
So I really liked Vacation a lot. Another movie that Dane Marty came in last week and reviewed that Jimmy and I had not seen, but we now have, is Woody Allen's newest, Irrational Man. I have reviewed, I think, the past six Woody Allen movies for WeAreMovieGeeks.com because I am a huge Woody Allen fan. And this new one, you know, we were talking to Dane last week. We were like, Dane, is it a comedy or a drama? And we couldn't really get a straight answer out of Dane. I think it's a very, very serious drama. I think it's in the vein of, maybe not Interiors, but certainly Blue Jasmine. You know, a few sort of nervous chuckles. But
yeah, like Match Point, maybe.
Maybe Match Point, and it's similar to Match Point. It's about an existential look at murder, and I think he talks about the aesthetics of getting away with the perfect murder. It's about this college professor who's having an affair with his coworkers and his students, but he's sort of impotent until he gets this idea to kill a perfect stranger. Woody Allen has sort of dealt with this topic before in Crimes and Misdemeanors and Match Point and Cassandra's Dream, too, were all about murders and getting away with murders and the moral implications of getting away with murder. Although this is different in that Joaquin Phoenix is murdered a stranger, and his motive is really just sort of exists in his head.
Well, you know, there is the overheard conversation.
True.
Yeah. I don't know if you could ever really hear a conversation that well in a diner, you know, sitting unless they're talking very loudly.
Yeah. But I just loved it. I thought it was another great script by Woody Allen. So much better than his last film, which was Magic in the Moonlight. Mm-hmm. Woody Allen is such a great economical director. He doesn't waste a moment. His movies, you know, you'll never see people walking and then sitting down and talking. They're just talking right away. So even though his movies are relatively short, this one's, I think, 95 minutes, which is kind of average for a Woody, they're so dense, and there are so many great characters and so much great writing that he manages to stuff in his films. And this one's certainly disappointing. Although, Jim, I don't think you liked it as much as I did.
No, I thought it was a little too similar to those other films, but not as strong. I could never really buy Joaquin Phoenix as this stud that gets all the women's, you know, ears kind of perked up as soon as he arrives at the campus. I didn't quite get that. I did enjoy Emma Stone in it.
Emma Stone was fabulous. I mean, I in a perfect world, she'd get an Oscar nomination for that. I think we were expecting Parker Posey's role to be a little flashier, weren't you?
Yeah. It seems like she's
the one who got all the buzz.
Yeah. She's not. She's supposed to be sort of this passionate other professor that immediately falls for Joaquin. But I don't know. There just wasn't anything that was really clicking in their scenes together. And she always looked like she was just kind of tired or worried.
Or
about
she's always on the verge of tears or something like that. But Emma Stone really has to go through a whole range of emotions in this film: love and fear and worry and just, she's really, really great.
I was going to say the fellow that's playing her boyfriend, who actually gets top billing, I guess, because of the alphabetical listing.
Yeah.
He has Buckley. He doesn't have much to do besides just kind of wring his hands and he's, you know, saying, could we please stop talking about your professor?
Yeah. And that was a kind of a running serious gag. But Woody Allen's always been known for writing stronger female roles than male roles. And this is no exception, but I highly recommend Irrational Man. In fact, I think it's probably my favorite film I've seen this year, besides Mad Max Fury Road, of course.
But you better hurry. Yeah. Go see it.
Those Woodies hang around. It'll be at the Frontenac for at least a month.
I was going to say, it's not going to be hanging around as long as Blue Jasmine or something like that.
Perhaps not, but again, I really, really liked it a lot, so I do recommend Irrational Man. That is, of course, the famous Zither film from the 1949 classic, The Third Man. They restored The Third Man, and it opens this Friday over at the Tivoli here in St. Louis, and I guess it opens nationwide as well. It's a classic movie. I had never seen it on the big screen. They had an advanced screening of it the other day. A grand total of three local critics showed up to look at it, and boy, did it look good, and it's held up really, really well. Like I said, 1949. Joseph Cotten plays a sort of a pulp writer, American pulp writer, who travels to Vienna in Austria to visit his friend Harry Lime. When he arrives, he's found out that Harry has died the day before and been run over by a truck in front of his apartment complex. And then there becomes this mystery. Who is the third man that was seen carrying the body of Harry Lime away, hence the title? And he finds out that his friend Harry Lime was a pretty shady character involved in all sorts of underground activities, including importing or stealing, I should say, tainted penicillin and then giving it to children in hospitals, which is causing all sorts of death and disease. And Harry Lime is quite the black-hearted villain. It's not giving away much to say that Harry Lime is not dead. He shows up in the person of Orson Welles about halfway through the film.
That's one of the greatest introductions in a film in ever. You know, that's right up there with John Wayne and Stagecoach.
Yeah. Thank you.
That zoom in there is just incredible.
Yeah. And then there's this all the stuff in the sewers of Vienna, these chases and scenes. It's just a spectacular movie. If you haven't seen it on the big screen, and I would say most people have not, it's going to be released nationwide. It looks so great. It's been restored. I don't know if they've put it in new scenes. I don't think they have.
Well, there's been so many, you know, sort of bootleg copies floating around for so long.
It was in the public domain.
Yeah. And it's going to be great to see it all, polished and shined up. Yeah. And it's got, besides the introduction of Orson as this Harry Lime, it's got that great bit of dialogue, I think, on the Ferris wheel, is it, between him and Joseph Cotton about society and the kind of society that produces things.
Yeah, Swiss society produces the cuckoo clock after years of...
100 years of peace and neutral. What do they produce? Yeah. The cuckoo clock.
Yeah. And then there's this actress, Alida Valli. She really wasn't in much. I looked her up. She was in Eyes Without a Face, which is a great French horror film from the early 60s. But she's very sexy and very good in this film.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why she didn't have much of a career. Apparently, the studio wanted to put James Stewart in the Joseph Cotton role, and Cary Grant is Harry Lime at one point, which would have been a completely different film. It was directed by Carol Reed, a famous British director who directed Oliver. Did he win the Oscar for directing Oliver? He won Best Picture.
In 68, something like that. Yeah. It wasn't Schlesinger that year. No, that was in 69. Yeah.
It meant Carol Reed. Carol Reed is actually the uncle of Oliver Reed, who co-starred in Oliver in 1968.
Yeah. Now, isn't The Third Man, isn't it in Peter Jackson's movie? I always get it confused whether it's Beautiful Creatures or Heavenly Creatures.
Yeah, Heavenly Creatures.
Heavenly Creatures.
Yeah, that's right. They're
obsessed with Orson Welles and the two girls in it.
Yeah.
And they go to see The Third Man at their local cinema.
Yeah. And that was the same year Ed Wood came out. Orson Welles popped up in that one as well.
Played by Vincent D'Onofrio.
That's right. I don't know who played him in Heavenly Creatures, but he was sort of haunting Kate Winslet's dreams in Heavenly Creatures.
Oh, yeah. Very influential film. Great, great zither score.
Yeah.
And I'll try to go catch it on the big screen, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Apparently the guy who did the score, and I can't recall his name, opened a bar in Vienna after that movie came out called The Third Man. That was the name of his nightclub, and he would play his zither in his nightclub for decades until he passed away, actually.
Damn. Has some great cinematography by Robert Krasker.
Okay.
And Martin Scorsese said it's one of his, it's one of the all-time great films, and just character reveal. Mm-hmm. The introduction is just.
Yeah, it's a movie lover's movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I highly recommend seeing it on the big screen. Opening this Wednesday, Shaun the Sheep.
Shaun the Sheep and his flock know every trick to having a good time.
Michelle and I saw Shaun the Sheep Saturday morning. I took my 11-year-old who saw a commercial and thought it was a baby movie and didn't want to go and pouted all the way there. And I knew it was from Aardman Studios, who sort of got on the map a couple of decades ago with the Wallace and Gromit shorts. And Chicken Run was fantastic. All their movies have been worth seeing.
Oh, sure.
I think this is their best feature.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Jim hasn't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking forward to it. I wasn't aware until, I think, a review in Entertainment Weekly and when you two were talking about it, that it's pretty much in pantomime, huh?
Yeah, there's no dialogue.
There's no dialogue.
It's sort of a throwback to silent comedies again.
There's a lot of Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton feel to it. It has a great score by Ilan Eshkiri, who did Stella Alice and Black Sails,
Black Sea,
thank you. No, it's just, it's darling. I mean, this lovable little sheep.
It's funny. It's really funny.
From a Close Shave, the British TV series spawned from it. It has like 149 episodes.
Oh, really?
Anybody familiar with it? The theme song runs throughout, even a hip-hop at the end.
And Shaun the Sheep has 149 episodes?
Yeah, the British TV
series. They're 5 minutes long, I think. Aren't they short?
No. They're actually... Really? They're wow. You can watch them on YouTube.
I did, but the one I watched on YouTube was only 5 minutes long. Maybe it was just part of an episode.
Yeah. No, they're really... So, I mean, 7 years later from it to go from this TV show now to the big screen adaptation. It's really funny.
I'm sorry, I
kind of like the fact that there weren't any celebrity voices. I even said after the screening, sometimes you go to an animated film and there'll be all these celebrity voices and you'll say, I know that voice. And, who is that? I know that voice. And it becomes a distraction because you're not paying attention because you're thinking, who the heck am I listening to? And then you wait till the end credits to roll and you say, oh, yeah, it was Jason Bateman or something like that. You don't have any celebrity voices, so you don't have that problem.
There was never, the TV show, even the part of it in Close Shave, there are no voices. Mm. That's the thing. It's a lot of boop, 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 boop.
But the other Aardman films did have voices. Chicken Run had Mel Gibson and the Pirates movie had Hugh Grant.
Shaun the Sheep does not have any, so they stuck to their guns and said, you know what, we're not. They thought about it, but they said, nope, we're going to, for the diehards, we're going to stick to no voices.
Yeah, I think my choice for worst film of the year a few years ago was, I think, Hoodwink 2, and the first 2 minutes of the film is just identifying all the different celebrities that did the voices. Yeah. It's just their names on a black screen. I was like, really? Every little two-word dialogue bit has to be done by a celebrity? Yeah.
And that's
on,
why
man.
The score was so important in this, because, I mean, it is the voice of the movie.
Mm-hmm. And it is done in the stop-motion style.
Oh, yeah, it's Aardman all the way. I think it's their best film. Their last film was Pirates, which was moderately amusing, but I didn't really care for it. It's kind of... kind of forgettable.
The Academy likes them. Yeah. They're running a event on Aardman and all their films coming up this month. Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling it may show up as one of the nominees.
Five. Yeah.
Curse of the Were-Rabbit, Chicken Run, The mm-hmm. Pirates... Booty, or I can't remember the full title. Is that it for Aardman features?
Well, they did do a few CGI features. They did Flushed Away, which was a CGI, and I believe Arthur Christmas is from them also.
Okay. Yes. The characters in those films sort of look like Aardman characters.
Oh, yeah.
Now that you mention it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And I think Hugh Jackman's the voice in Flushed I believe it Flushed Away.
So Shaun the Sheep opens a Wednesday the 5th. I will be reviewing that over at WeAreMovieGeeks.com, and I will give it a solid 4.5 stars.
Great. Yeah, definitely go see it.
I really liked it a lot. I do recommend it. Straight out of Compton.
Why you gotta be so ruthless, cuz? I make a few changes.
Where you think you're going?
I'm just trying to get home.
That's my son.
You need to get back in the house or I will ruin your night.
I gotta talk to my moms like that.
That opens August 14th. That's from Universal Pictures. That is going to be huge.
And Melissa Thompson, who writes for We Are Movie Geeks but lives out in L.A., has seen it. What did she think? Have you talked to her about it?
Yes. She hit the junket yesterday, the big press conference. The running time is a solid 2 hours and 30 minutes. She said it's great. It's not only one of the best films of the year, it's one of, according to her, one of the best films of the last 5 years. Straight Out of Compton stars O'Shea Jackson Jr., Corey Hawkins, Jason Mitchell as Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, and Eazy-E. It's directed by F. Gary Gray, who brought us The Italian Job. It's about NWA. In 1987, five young men, Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, DJ Yella, and MC Ren, using brutally honest rhymes and hardcore beats, put their frustration and anger about the life in the most dangerous place in America for the most powerful weapon they had, their music. It's about the hip-hop group, how this all started NWA. NWA only did one album, but it's what they did with the industry.
They only did one album.
They did. But they all went on to do other, look at Ice Cube. They all went on. So when she covered the junket yesterday, she did speak with the director, F. Gary Gray, specifically because the whole thing was Suge Knight and muscling them out, of their contracts. He said, with the irony now, because as everyone knows, Suge Knight is going to be in jail for the next 20 to 30 years. It's a scene that they filmed, but, and he's in it, but they had no idea how things were going to turn out. All the actors had to get together for weeks before because they were all friends and everything. And these actors, most of them, are the sons of the real people.
And apparently Paul Giamatti plays the same character he played in the Beach Boys movie. Boy, that guy gets around.
Yeah, exactly. That's another standout. They said they all had to get in, listen to the tracks, watch videos to see. So she said it's a great movie. It really encapsulates what was going on at the time.
That opens, you say, on the 14th.
That opens up the 14th. Right. I think it's going to be really big.
We're seeing that, I think, a week from tomorrow night. So yes, we'll be able, yes. Well, we'll be able to talk about that for two more weeks.
So we will.
Our reviews.
Melissa Thompson will be reviewing, and she will have her press conference coverage up this week.
Well, she says it's one of the best movies of the past 5 years. I assume she's going to give it 5 out of 5 stars.
Yes, that's what she said. Right. Yeah, and she's not a fan of the music, but she said the way the movie is put together, this biopic of the time, is fantastic.
Yeah, that's the main interest I have for it. Not the, the music itself, but you know, the
background. And that's how she went in. Yeah, that's how she went into it, too.
And the fact that Ice Cube's son is playing him in the movie,
he looks
right?
just like him.
Exactly. Yeah, the only person that could not go by was Eazy-E because he had died of AIDS back in 95. And they had asked the actor, they were nervous about the scene, the death scene. And he said, I can cry at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. And they said, it's a really powerful scene.
Okay. Something to look forward to. Also,
definitely.
Man from U.N.C.L.E. also opens on the 14th.
Oh, and you have a new code name.
Code name? U.N.C.L.E.
Michelle has seen that. You're going to talk about a little more detail next week. But thumbs up or thumbs down?
Oh, huge thumbs up.
Okay,
Guy Ritchie's latest film.
It looks
film.
So great.
It is. The music, the makeup, the costumes, the cars, everything.
And who's that sexy actress that I like?
Alicia Vikander.
Yes, she's, from Ex Machina.
Does she have a big part in that?
She does.
Is she the main female lead?
She shares it with the other actress, but she's the main.
One,
yes,
from Great Gatsby was what the other one was in, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Now, I don't know if this is going to reveal to you. You talked about the music there. Do we have just a little bit of the classic score in there? I hope. I've been hearing online that it's not in there at all. The Jerry Goldsmith score.
No. Yeah. I hate to say
that. That was
although the score is from Daniel Pemberton, who did Prometheus. But I love what they did. They taken some different songs, different styles, different worldwide music. It's a really snappy, clever score.
That's good. That opens on the 14th. We can talk about that more
definitely.
In depth next week. Although Jim and I still won't have seen it because we're not seeing it until next Monday. But this week, the We Are Movie Geeks guys are going to be really, really busy. We've got screenings pretty much every night this week. Jim's going to a screening here this afternoon. What's that called?
That's The End of the Chore.
What's this story about in your mind?
Just what it's like to be the most talked about writer in the country, that sort of thing.
You're like a nervous guy, huh?
No. I'm okay. How are you?
Because I'm terrified.
That's Jesse Eisenberg and Jason Segel?
Yeah, that's getting a lot of Oscar buzz.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's a true story of about an interview, was it?
Yeah.
Like, well, you haven't seen
David,
it, so.
Yeah, David Foster Wallace, the writer, was going, I guess, on his last book tour, and he was paired up. I think that guy's name was David Spaney or something like that, who's played by Eisenberg, and Jason Segel plays David Foster Wallace, and it's all about them sort of on the road and stopping and getting fast food and talking, and the buzz is really good. Entertainment Weekly has a great profile of Jason Segel, and he's getting some real good Oscar buzz right now.
Well, good. Well, you'll give us your review of that a week from today. Tonight, we're seeing Ricky and the Flash.
I'm Ricky Randazzo, and I'd like to introduce my band... The Flash.
Starring Meryl Streep and her daughter, whose name is Mamie Gumma. This movie does not look very good to me.
Well, I'm kind of holding out some hope because it's directed by Jonathan Demme.
Yeah, so, exactly.
You know, I'm thinking he might. And, you know, Kevin Kline has a role in it. I know that. And the casting of Rick Springfield is kind of interesting.
People gone crazy over that.
Yeah, and the Winter Soldier is in it. I just found out Sebastian Stan is in it. So I'm trying to, you know, we'll see.
We go to these movies with an open mind. You know, this movie has a trailer that kind of makes you sneer. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a bad movie.
Yeah, we always hope the movies are good when
we
sit down.
We don't want to see a bad movie. I kind of enjoy reviewing bad movies, but I certainly don't want to sit through a bad movie, especially a boring movie. Mamie Gumma is, of course, Meryl Streep's daughter. And
Grummer. Grummer?
Grummer? Is that how you say it? I'm sorry. What did I say? Gumma?
I kind of like that.
All right. So, and that's written by Diablo Cody.
Oh,
this should be great.
Well, I don't know. Diablo Cody won the Oscar for Juno, and that was her very first screenplay, and she hasn't really followed up with much. She did a movie called Jennifer's Body with Megan Fox, which was really a disaster.
Well, young adult,
yeah,
I
young
enjoyed.
Young adult was better, yeah.
Yeah.
And she done anything else? Is this just her fourth
screenplay? I can't recall.
Yeah. This may just be her fourth screenplay. So maybe she'll save this thing. She has this sort of, I don't know, ironic hipster edge to her writing, which it works. It certainly worked in Juno. It did not work in Jennifer's Body. I would say young adult was a little more... little more conventional in her writing. It was a funny movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very funny.
So we'll see what this Ricky and the Flash is like. And then tomorrow night we're seeing The Gift.
Gordo?
What does bygones be bygones mean?
It's over!
Simon has a full file on him. You think he's been lying to you?
Just tell me what happened.
It's 25 years ago.
I have no idea who you really are.
It's gotten good buzz. The trailer looks very, like a very Simon conventional says. Stalker, bunny boiler, as I like to call
him. Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't it?
A little bit of Single White Female, a little bit of Fatal Attraction.
But
know?
The buzz is the trailer is misleading, which I don't know why they would put a trailer that, make a trailer that looks like 25,000 other movies, and then the movie, but maybe it was a hard movie to cut a trailer around. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm kind of looking forward to it.
It's directed by Joel Edgerton, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's the co-star of it.
Yeah. He plays the stalker, and Jason Bateman and Rebecca Hall, who I really like, play the stalkees.
Yep.
So we'll be back next week with details on that.
Yeah.
They are dangerous and powerful, which makes them extremely valuable to the government.
Another movie we're seeing this week, which opens Friday, is The New Fantastic Four. Talked in depth about Marvel movies a couple weeks ago. With when Ant-Man came out, the new Fantastic Four, I don't know, looks okay. What do you think, Jim?
I don't know. It looks way too dark to me. I'm hoping it'll be better than the previous two that came out about the last 10 or 12 years. Yeah. But I don't know. It just you know, the cast is too young for my taste. I think Reed Richards and Ben Grimm should be a little older.
Yeah.
But I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Who directed
for
this?
This is by the fellow that directed Chronicle.
Okay.
I can't recall.
Josh
Trunk.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Say the other films were, I think, directed by Tim Story. So I hope
I like
good.
The score. The score is from Marco Beltrami and Philip Glass. They collaborated on this one. It sounds really. It's on Spotify right now. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of got that superhero feeling. So it's got that going for it.
Okay. Well, we'll be back next Monday and we'll have our review of who's reviewing it for our site.
I believe Michael is.
Okay, Michael will be Michael reviewing Hafner. It at WeAreMovieGeeks.com on Friday, and the three of us will be back next Monday to give our thoughts on it. Another movie that opens this Friday is called Tangerine.
Cindy's back on the block?
Oh, yeah, she's back. She's back and she's going hard.
Merry Christmas, bitch.
Woo!
It's by the director of Starlet, which was an interesting movie that came out a couple years ago with Dree Hemingway, who's Mariel Hemingway's daughter. Tangerine was shot on an iPhone.
Yeah, I saw the trailer for that. So you saw the trailer?
I watched the trailer, and it's about two black hookers. And I tell you,
transgender hookers.
Are they transgender hookers? I wonder why they were so ugly. It reminded me of White Chicks. It really did. I go, I don't know. Why would I want to spend 90 minutes with these two women? They are very unattractive. They're very obnoxious. The trailer looks like a train wreck. But then again, this director has done good work in the past. So
yeah, it looks like their energy level is like out of 10. It's like at a 15 through the whole movie.
That's how naive. I did not know they were men. Well, are you sure about that?
I am certain.
Okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah.
Oh, God. So that's Tangerine. It was shot on, like we said, it was shot on their iPhones.
That's becoming more and more common now.
You'll see that.
It looks, the picture quality looks okay to me, you know?
Yeah, I just wonder about the audio quality. And they must have used professional microphones.
Yeah, I hope they had them all mic'd and all that.
I don't know.
Yeah, it looks like they're using a lot of gritty, real locations in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So,
Stephen Jones will be reviewing that for We Are Movie Geeks this Friday. And I don't know, maybe one of us will see it over the weekend and have some thoughts on it next week on We Are Movie Geeks, the podcast. Call Me Lucky is from director Bobcat Goldthwait, who's a great director. Have you ever seen The World's Greatest Dad?
World's Greatest Dad is
thank
great.
Fantastic.
That's a great movie.
And God Bless America.
Well, you know, there's another one called Sleeping Dogs Lie. You ever seen that?
No, was that his attempt at a horror film?
No. Sleeping Dogs Lie was a dark, dark comedy about a college-age woman who performs oral sex on her dog. Just out of boredom.
Oh, okay, I heard of this.
And then she confesses that to her fiance, and it's the word spreads around what she's done, and it ruins her life and drives her mother to an early grave. And it's really a fascinating, incredibly well-written movie that's called Sleeping Dogs Lie. I just
Yeah, did Bobcat direct Shakes the Clown also?
Yeah, that was his first film.
Oh, yeah.
That's a classic documentary.
He starred in that, too. But he wakes up in bed with Florence Henderson at the beginning, and she pukes all over him.
So this is a documentary,
yeah.
you said?
This is a documentary. It showed at Sundance. I have seen it. It's funny, but it's heartbreaking.
Barry Crimmins is the comic at the center of it?
He is. He is. And they have interviews with Barry Crimmins, David Cross, Margaret Cho, Patton Oswalt.
Barry Crimmins was this weird mythical force.
He spawned all of these great humorists.
Paula Poundstone.
Lenny, Kevin Meaney, Dennis Leary.
He was a guy who you heard about before you actually saw him.
This whispered about presence.
I never met anyone like him.
He's just this combination of Noam Chomsky and Bluto.
The insight into this is from Patton Oswalt. It's really well done. Barry Crimmins, a bear-swilling, politically outspoken, and whip-smart comic whose efforts in the 70s and 80s fostered the talents of the next generation of stand-up comedians. But beneath Crimmins' gruff, hard-drinking, curmudgeonly persona lay an undercurrent of rage stemming from his long-suppressed and horrific abuse, which is awful, as a child, the rage that eventually found its way to the comedy clubs and TV shows and into the political arena.
Yeah. Okay, and we have an interview really with Bobcat. Who did that?
Yes, actually, we're interviewing Bobcat Goldthwait today. Melissa Thompson will be interviewing him, and she'll have that posted.
So that'll be up at We Are Movie Geeks this week?
Yeah, I hate to say it. I'm not familiar with Barry Crimmins. So,
I'm not either. I watched the trailer. Who the heck is this guy?
Right, but when you listen to David Cross and Patton Oswalt, especially, it's just...
Oh, those guys I know,
but they even say in the trailer there's this classic... legendary comedian that no one's ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like
Bill Hicks or something, who was the comedian's comedian, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It got rave reviews out of Sundance, so we'll have the review also up this week.
I'll be interested to see it,
So did me and Earl the Dying Girl, so I no longer trust Sundance. Several things going on here in town this week. You know, there's always something going on in St. Louis. I think we talked a little bit about street trash, but Andy over at Destroy the Brain does the monthly late night grindhouse at the High Point over at Skinker and Clayton. And the midnight show this week is street trash. Street trash is about bums who drink this wine called Viper and their stomachs all explode. That's pretty much the whole plot of Street Trash. But it's a very, very entertaining movie. I saw it at the Varsity back in 1987. It was the last movie to play at the Varsity. So that's something to look forward to. Zardoz, we talked about that briefly, too. That's the one with Sean Connery and his big red diaper.
Zardoz speaks to you. His chosen ones. The gun is good.
That was made in 1974, directed by John Boorman. Horribly reviewed in 1974, but it sort of developed something of a cult following.
Oh, yeah. He used to say pop culture references to it all the time. Yeah, yeah.
And Charlotte Rampling, I believe, is in it as well.
Oh, yes.
So something to look forward to. I will be introducing that at the Tivoli, and I will have some Zardoz trivia. Dracula, 1931. What a classic. That will be showing this Thursday at Schlafly Bottle Works. I will be introducing that as well, and I may have some Dracula trivia.
I am Dracula.
Dracula. The very mention of the name brings to mind things so evil, so fantastic, so degrading, you wonder if it isn't all a dream, a nightmare.
That is a fundraiser for Helping Kids Together, which is a charity that sends kids with health issues on trips and things like that.
Yeah, it's amazing that came out the same year as the Karloff Frankenstein, mm-hmm. you know, to have such hugely influential films just being blockbusters in the same year mm-hmm. within months apart is just amazing mm-hmm. to me.
And of course, Lon Chaney Sr. was scheduled to star in both of those films and died suddenly in 1930. Dracula is directed by Todd Browning. And I can make an announcement right now. I will be hosting a tribute to Todd Browning at this year's St. Louis International Film Festival. I believe it's November 12th or November 14th or 13th, whatever that Friday is, mm-hmm. Second Friday of November. And Todd Browning directed 7 movies with Lon Chaney Sr. The most famous, I would say, is probably London After Midnight, which is the one that's vanished. Mm-hmm. It's a lost film. It's probably the most famous lost film of all. It's got a real mystery to it because... some film journalists had watched screenings of it as late as the 1940s and 1950s. So it hadn't, you know, it's a movie that people think exists in private collections, but no one's able to track it down. Anyways, that's not the film we're going to be showing at the SLIFF event. We're going to be showing...
that would be a scoop.
That would be. Yeah. We're showing a film he made, Todd Browning made with Lon Chaney Sr. in 1927 called The Unknown, which is my favorite silent film of all time.
Wow.
It's absolutely amazing. Lon Chaney plays Alonzo the Armless, an armless knife thrower in a Spanish circus at the turn of the century, and he's in love with a 19-year-old Joan Crawford. So he's throwing... knives at her with his feet, and she had been molested as a child, so she can't stand to be touched by a man, so they're the perfect match, but there are many, many twists and turns. It's a pretty dark film.
Well, I tell you, most people just know Chaney from The Phantom of the Opera or Hunchback, but you see some of these other films, what a twisted film roster he's got there. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And that will be accompanied by live music from the Rats and People Motion Picture Orchestra, and I will be talking about that in the months ahead. Let's see. Okay, our friend and colleague Joe Williams passed away. Was that just last Sunday?
That was a week ago last night.
He was killed in a one-car accident. He was president of the St. Louis Film Critics Association, of which Jim and I are both members of. Really a good writer. Nice guy, a good writer. I didn't always agree with his opinions. In fact, there was some times where I was like, Joe, how could you like this movie? Or Joe, how could you hate this movie? I love this movie. But he was always just really a eloquent writer. One thing I liked about Joe's reviews is they were relatively brief. He would never ramble on and on in his reviews. He would publish these 500-600-word reviews and get right to the point.
Oh, sure. You know, but I was disagreeing with him just up a few weeks ago. I was like, Entourage, a star more than Spy, really?
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, it was a great deal to get into discussions with him and really knew his stuff. That's the main thing.
And when I every year I go out to cover the Oscars in the press room, it's always great to see him. He always throws a party on Friday nights for everybody from the Midwest who's out covering the Oscars. He loved to talk Oscars, like films, even what was coming early on in the year, what, you know, our thoughts, what might make it, what wouldn't.
So Cinema St. Louis will be teaming up at the Landmark Tivoli Theater this Saturday for a tribute to Joe Williams. That starts at 11 a.m. It is free, but they want you to buy tickets in advance or get tickets in advance.
Yeah.
Go by the Tivoli box office or go to Landmark Tivoli website. Starting at 11 a.m., several people, a lot of people we know, will be standing up talking about Joe, anecdotes about Joe's life, a tribute to Joe Williams. Joe Williams' favorite movie of all time. I think it's Michelle's favorite movie of all time, too. It's A Wonderful Life. We'll be screening after the tributes to Joe, so I imagine maybe around noon they will start It's a Wonderful Life.
If you haven't seen that on the big screen, it's really, really a handsome film.
It's amazing. And they show that actually every Christmas time over at the High Point, and it packs them in.
Oh, sure.
Now, is the High Point running on something this weekend?
Yes, they are. To Kill a Mockingbird.
And so... A quiet, humble, respectable Negro who has had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman has had to put his word against two white people.
Is that only Saturday morning?
Saturday morning at 10:30. Now, there's this new novel by Harper Lee who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. Is it called Comes a Watchman or something?
Get a Watchman.
Something like that. And it's a sequel. This cracks me up. It's a sequel to Kill a Mockingbird, and this is outraging. Some people are just getting the vapors over this. But it takes place, a couple of decades after To Kill a Mockingbird, and Atticus Finch is this racist who goes to Ku Klux Klan meetings. And I guess he's confronted by a grown-up scout. You know, all these people that name their kids after characters from the Kill a Mockingbird. I know people have named their sons Atticus, and they must just be aghast. But that will be showing at 10:30 at the High Point. So... And that's usually introduced by Harry Hamm, and that is $5. And it's always a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess we're going to wrap it up for today. We'll be back next week with reviews of all these movies that we're going to see this week. What's the one you're seeing again today?
Well, I'm going to see The End of the Tour.
Okay. Jim's going to review The End of the Tour. We'll talk about Ricky and the Flash, Fantastic Four, The Gift. We'll see how Tangerine turns out, Man from U.N.C.L.E. Boy, it's a busy time of the year, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I tell you. It's the last big rush to the end of summer, huh?
Exactly, before we creep into Oscar season.
All right, so we do recommend Shaun the Sheep. We really recommend Mission Impossible. I liked the Woody Allen's Irrational Man. Jim did not. The Third Man, a must-see, will be at the Frontenac starting Friday.
Mr. Holmes, we can all recommend
Now. You know, it's a lot of... You know, the end of the summer is more interesting because at the beginning of the summer it seems like the same movies are playing in like all the screens, and mm-hmm. now we're getting there's more movies to see. I think
definitely.
So definitely check back next week at We Are Movie Geeks, the podcast. I'm Tom Stockman,
Michelle McHugh,
Jim Batts.
All right, we're tuning out for now.
Black leather, black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.